This afternoon, the distinguished senator from our largest state will address us on the subject, do we need governmental secrecy? Mike Gravel was born in Springfield, Massachusetts on May the 13th, 1930. He received his primary education in the parochial school systems of Springfield and Worcester, Massachusetts. His college career was interrupted by a three-year stint in the United States Army in which he rose from private to first lieutenant. On being discharged from the Army, he resumed his college career and received a Bachelor of Science degree in economics from Columbia University. From Columbia, he went to Alaska and was engaged in the real estate business. In 1962, he was bitten by the political bug and won a seat in the state legislature. He was reelected in 1964 and became Speaker of the House. In 1968, he defeated the incumbent Senator Ernest Greening from Alaska and now occupies Alaska's Democratic seat in the Senate. It is my pleasure to introduce Mike Gravel.
Thank you very much. I can say it's a very distinct pleasure being here and talking before this very, very famous speakers forum. But first, before launching into my text, I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce a friend, a colleague, and companion who is sharing this vacation with me in beautiful California. And that, of course, is my wife, who's back there, Rita Gravel. If sitting next to her is a friend who she's dining with, and that, of course, is Assemblywoman March Fong. March, would you please come with me? I don't want to miss this opportunity and thank, in behalf of all Alaskans, somebody who's done something we think is very unusual, and that is your state senator, Al Aquist, who traveled all the way to Alaska not 2 months ago to give testimony before the AEC on the possible ecological effects that would take place as a result of the Amchitka blast, which is announced to be exploded in October. And I want to thank Al, not only personally, but in behalf of Alaskans, and hope that we're successful in stopping that blast from taking place. Al. And finally, to thank the person responsible for getting me to California and actually arranging my travel, and a person who I think has served you well and will continue to serve you well as a very distinguished young man, a very able young man. And that's my good friend, Wally Karabian, who happens to be the majority leader of your state assembly. Wally. I don't customarily speak from a written text, but because of the import of this particular subject, I wanted to be very precise in the statement that I make. And for this reason, I hope you'll bear with me as I take on a prepared text. H.G. Wells once wrote, quote, "The true strength of rulers and empires lies not in armies or emotions, but in the belief of men that they are inflexibly open and truthful and legal. As soon as a government departs from that standard, it ceases to be anything more than the gang in possession, and its days are numbered." End of quote. Nowhere is this more true than in the conduct of the affairs of a representative government. That is why our forefathers created a government of laws rather than of men and enshrined that distinction in a written constitution. That is why our forefathers insisted upon attaching a Bill of Rights to our constitution, guaranteeing maximum competition in the marketplace of ideas. These protections ensure the active and full participation of an enlightened electorate. This, indeed, is the source of our strength. Remove this participation, and you have democracy in name only. Participatory democracy is not the recent product of SDS or liberal rhetoric. Participation by the people directly in government is the source of our system embodied in the town meeting. This nation was founded at the town meeting, where all citizens had a voice in the discretions of government. Support for the policies was ensured by the fact that they were made by the people affected. Over a period of time, the center of decision-making authority has escaped the people. The result has been adoption of policies that do not have the understanding or support of the people. At great cost, we have learned that people must participate in the critical decisions of government that affect their lives. In today's technological society, it is possible to recapture the public participation in decision-making inherent in the town meeting. This must be done now if we are to be masters and not victims of our technology. It is not enough for the people to have faith in their government. Those in government must demonstrate their faith in the people as well. People must be brought back into the decision-making process. Likewise, the Congress must assert its authority to play a proper role in the conduct of national and international affairs. Congress is a conduit of information to the people. If Congress is misled, the people will be misled. The people do not want, nor should they any longer be subjected to, the paternalistic protection of an executive that believes it alone has the right answers. For too long, both the people and the Congress have been denied access to the needed data upon which to base judgments of national policy. For too long, they have been spoon-fed information designed to sustain predetermined decisions and denied information which questioned those decisions. For too long, we have been forced to subsist on a diet of half-truths or deliberate deceit by executives or their appointees who consider the people and their Congress as adversaries. The arrogance of power is having a heyday because those who wield the vast power of the state have become insulated from accountability. This accountability has been foreclosed by the stamp marked secret, which not only classifies documents, but when used, as it has been in our recent nation's past history, establishes a barrier between those who govern and those who are governed. A barrier of secrecy has been permitted to insulate the executive from the public under the guise of national security. Secrecy is anathema to a democracy. People have a right to know what goes on in government. People need to know what goes on in government. Our elected officials, the president, members of Congress, have a responsibility and an obligation to let the people know. To do otherwise demonstrates a basic mistrust in the collective wisdom of the people and a frightening lack of confidence in our form of government. I'm not talking about military secrets vital to our national security. We all recognize the necessity of exercising judgment in withholding data relating to our strategic developments, deployments, our weaponry, our battle plans, the immediate safety of our troops, and certain diplomatic negotiations. Those who cite such items as justifying secrecy in government miss the point completely. Executive privacy, like personal privacy, is not the issue here. What I'm talking about is the formulation and execution of national policy, something that must involve the people. The policy of whether we go to war or remain at peace. Whether the exploitation of atomic energy to satisfy our energy needs is ecologically sound, as opposed to a greater effort in the broader spectrum of alternatives. Whether we are to pursue a strategy of benign neglect in our approach to the problems of racial injustice, or attack the issues of discrimination and unrest openly and with full commitment. Whether we are to accept increased unemployment and reduced public services as the proper tools for curbing inflation, or to implement wage and price controls to begin the management of an ailing economy, which I'm happy to say has recently been initiated. These are the type of issues where the people and their Congress must be provided with all the executive information and thinking available if we are to have participatory democracy. I say again, the process of making policy must be shared by the people who suffer that policy. This is a fundamental check in our system of checks and balances. If this check on the use of power is abrogated, then our system of representative government will pass into history as just another experiment at self-government. Secrecy as the tool of abrogation cannot be more aptly demonstrated than by the controversy surrounding the disclosure of the Pentagon study on the origins of our involvement in Vietnam. The Pentagon Papers tell us many stories replete with accounts of the purposeful withholding and distortion of facts to assure the institution of policies neither wanted nor sanctioned by the public or the Congress. There are no military secrets to be found in these papers. There is nothing in the Pentagon Papers that jeopardizes the security of our nation or endangers the well-being of our boys anywhere in the world. But what you do find in the Pentagon Papers are political secrets sustained only by an appalling litany of faulty premises and questionable objectives built one upon the other over the course of five separate administrations. It is the tragic story of how this nation became embroiled in a war that never should have been, for purposes that did not square with the facts, and at a cost of life, treasure, and social progress that can never be recouped. No one who reads this amazing study can fail to conclude that had the true facts relative to Vietnam been made known to the people, that the war would long ago have ended, and the needless deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans and Vietnamese would have been averted. No greater argument against the unchecked use of secrecy in the government can be found in the annals of American history. This is a great lesson to be learned from the Pentagon Papers. This is why I felt compelled to release this material when it came into my possession. The Pentagon Papers deserve the widest possible dissemination. Every American is entitled to the opportunity of examining and digesting for himself the lessons they contain as a means for ensuring that never again will this great nation be duped into waging a war under false pretenses. This was a prime factor in my original decision to release the materials I had received to the public. This also is why I'm pleased to be able to announce today that the Pentagon Papers, which I placed into the record of the special hearing of my subcommittee on public grounds and buildings, will soon be published in book form. Beacon Press of Boston, Massachusetts, the publishing house of the Unitarian Universalist Association, is preparing a four-volume edition of the complete text and supporting documents, which I released on June 29th from the Pentagon study. The books will be available to the public in paperback and hardcover across the nation by middle or late October. I hope that my actions will shorten, even if by one day, the senseless killing and destruction in Southeast Asia. The Pentagon Papers reveal the inner workings of a governmental bureaucracy out of control, created to defend this country, but now managing an international empire, garrisoning American troops around the world. Because secrecy has warped our system of checks and balances. The executive was permitted to wage an undeclared war in foreign lands, thereby usurping the congressional powers to declare and wage war. The tolerance of secrecy assented to in evolutionary degrees by all elements of our system of representative government, is the root of this once proud nation being mired down in the muck of Indochina. In the name of national defense and communist containment, our peace-loving American people have become the scourge of Asians, who unfortunately have sufficient quarrels of their own. The reader of these papers can trace a fantastic sequence of secret political maneuverings as our government, step by step, created an artificial client state in South Vietnam, bemoaned the unpopularity of the government it had installed, eventually encouraged and supported the overthrow of that government, and then manipulated the resulting series of military dictators who serve their own ends, and at times the ends of our government, but never, never, never the cause of their own people, the Vietnamese people. The papers show that American policy towards Southeast Asia has been characterized by a pattern of deception, a deception of the American people and of their representatives in Congress, which has continued for 20 years and which continues today through the present administration. In 1964, the Pentagon's Sigma War Games had indicated that a bombing campaign directed at North Vietnam would not bring the enemy, the North Vietnamese, the enemy, to its knees. This is the advice from our military leaders within the Pentagon to our political leaderships. The results of the Sigma Games were dismissed by a political policy decision. The accuracy of the military forecast rapidly came to pass because far from causing them to cave in and call off their assistance to the Viet Cong, our bombings of North Vietnam strengthened their determination to continue the struggle, just as bombings in previous cases, as we well know from the epic Battle of Britain, has enabled a country to pull together to oppose its enemies. Yet we continue to bomb today, not to sustain a military tactic, but rather to shore up a bankrupt political posture. In June 1964, the President of the United States, in an effort to ascertain the validity of the domino theory, mind you, this was in June 1964, asked his own intelligence analysts whether, quote, "The rest of Southeast Asia necessarily would fall if Laos and South Vietnam came under North Vietnamese control," end of quote. The CIA's frequently valid estimates were that, quote, "With the possible exception of Cambodia, it is likely that no nation in the area would quickly succumb to communism as a result of the fall of Laos and South Vietnam. Furthermore, a continuation of the spread of communism in the area would not be inexorable, and any spread which did occur would take time, time in which the total situation might change in any number of ways unfavorable to the communist cause," end of quote from a CIA analysis. Yet, in late 1970, now that request by the president to his intelligence people was 1964, in late 1970, the President of the United States, another gentleman, some 6 years later, after the CIA report, stated on television, under repeated intensive questioning, that our continued involvement in Vietnam was because of the domino theory. The barrier of secrecy allows the discussion of policy within the government to evolve a party line structure, in which only those who accepted the orthodox position were allowed to participate. The result was that no serious review was given to the postulates underlying our policy, and no real attention was given to possible alternatives. This barrier of secrecy insulates and perpetuates ignorance at the highest level of government. It flatters the policymakers into thinking they really know something the people do not. Similarly, it lulls the people into a psychological security that their leadership has access and possesses information that they do not have. As a result, the people almost automatically defer to the judgments of those supposedly informed leaders. In truth, the exact opposite occurs. Our leadership, because of secrecy, is denied the challenge of public competitive dialogue, the counsel of reason, broad academic discourse, and the just approbation that comes from taking policy forward into the light of a free society for approval. The Pentagon Papers offer us an unusual commentary on the moral sensibilities of our policymakers. At no time did they evince any concern for the effects of our policy upon the Vietnamese people. A move to escalate the war was no different from a decision to purchase a new airplane. It was all a day's work. The attitude of American officials toward their client counterparts in Saigon was the lace curtain treatment dealt out to the dinks, slobs, and gooks by the American soldiers in the field. The Pentagon Papers show that our leaders never understood the human commitment which underscored the nationalistic movement in Vietnam. Our leaders still today do not appreciate the degree to which the people of Vietnam are willing to sacrifice in what they consider to be a century-long struggle to eliminate colonialism. Our executive leaders live in an air-conditioned, isolated world of surgical airstrikes and Viet Cong infrastructure, when the reality before us is the maiming of women and children to no purpose. In 1961, our intelligence estimates counted 20,000 active Viet Cong in South Vietnam and few North Vietnamese, except for advisors comparable to our Green Berets in the South. The enemy ranks grew in relation to our increased involvement, leading to the clear conclusion that the Vietnamese people developed a greater resolve to fight with each escalating step taken by us to prosecute the war. Rather than defeating an enemy, we were creating one. The Pentagon Papers show that our leaders sought to keep their plans from the American people, even as they telegraphed their intentions to the enemy as part of a deliberate strategy to cause him to back down. Both the American public and the enemy were viewed as audiences before whom various postures of determination, conciliation, strength, and will would have to be portrayed. Yet the enemy knew what we, the American people, were not permitted to know. The elaborate secrecy precautions, the carefully contrived subterfuges, were intended not to deceive the other side, but to deceive the American public. The Pentagon Papers show that public statements of optimism used to generate public support for the war were contrary to the intelligence estimates being given our leaders. While we were told that just a few more soldiers, a few more bombing runs would turn the tide, the intelligence estimates were quite clear in warning that escalation would bring no significant change in the status of the war. The Pentagon Papers show that a negotiated peace was not on the American agenda of Southeast Asia. We repeatedly sabotaged and/or avoided conferences which might bring the conflict to an end. We knew that our side was too weak to sustain at the bargaining table. We therefore sought a result without success on the battlefield. This is the case today. Our government just recently sought restricted secret sessions in Paris as a response to an apparent good faith proposal by North Vietnam, a proposal which they said, mind you, was negotiable, all of it. What policy is this administration prosecuting in this obvious effort to stall the negotiations in Paris. Is it a policy understood and sanctioned by the people of this country? This administration is pursuing a policy of continued war without purpose to our security in order to save face. If the impact of this policy were known and understood by the American people, it would convulse their moral sensibilities. The war is still in progress. People, human beings, are being killed at this very moment. Killed as a direct result of policy decisions made in secret. Arms are being severed. Metal is crashing through human bodies because of a policy conceived in secret and still kept from the American people. All this and much more, as the Pentagon Papers clearly show. Basically, there are three major conclusions to be drawn from this sad saga. First, our involvement in Vietnam was and continues to be a dreadful mistake. This statement of fact, now conclusively proven by the Pentagon study, is accepted at all levels of government and by the American people. However, the greatest representative democracy the world has ever known, the nation of Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, has had and continues to have its nose rubbed in a swamp by petty warlords, jealous Vietnamese generals, black marketeers, and grand-scale dope pushers. The policy of winding down the war to an honorable peace in order to save face is as phony a goal as destroying people and land to give them a chance to survive. The present administration took office under the vague and secret promise of coming forth with a plan for peace. Unfortunately, time, 2.5 years, has allied this administration with the mistaken policies of 4 prior administrations. The tragedy of this alignment is fully seen in the statistic that 1/3 of all the casualties taken in Vietnam since our involvement have been suffered since January 1969. 1/3 of all the casualties. 1/3 of all the deaths and wounded since this administration has initiated a policy of winding down the war. When an individual errs and admits it, this is considered virtue. Why can't our nation seek similar virtue in ending a policy of war that has been and continues to be wrong? We should get out of Vietnam. We should get out now. Second, the people should participate, and governmental leaders should bend every effort at permitting this participation in making public policy, and this should be done now. Public participation and its need for information does not square well with the recent efforts by our government in stopping the publication of the Pentagon Papers. Obedience to secrecy laws and national security are the feeble rationales of the present administration's zealous judicial activity. This rationale readily evaporates as one reads the Pentagon Papers. Consider this parallel. The civilian military leadership at the Pentagon initiated a study in 1967 before the Tet Offensive, in order to find out what went wrong with our policy in Vietnam. The need for the people to know what went wrong, as well as those who live in the bowels of the Pentagon, is 1,000 times more important, since the people in our system make the final judgment. Third is the simple conclusion that there is no justification for the kind of secrecy that has been permitted to engulf our governmental operations. The standards for protective classification for information should be revised, and revised now. Automatic time limits should be an integral part of classification. The number of persons authorized to classify should be curtailed to a fraction of their present number. The benefits of the Freedom of Information Act, so skillfully exploited by Ralph Nader to the public interest, should be extended to include national security activities intentionally omitted under that law. Our security and man's survival are matters much too important to be left to a decision-making process steeped in secrecy and denied the enriching experience of public examination. what a new experience it would be for our governmental leaders to bring forth all the necessary information and speak to the nation's security so that all can understand and all can deliberate upon. The war this nation continues to wage today could not have developed without the tool of secrecy. The abuses of secrecy are widespread and uncontrolled. They have fostered distrust between the executive and legislative branches and have created a serious gulf between the government and its people. In 1971, today, nearly 100,000 members of the armed forces and hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent so that the military can spy upon civilians. One agency can keep tabs on another so that the military can promote its interest and so that the military can monitor the public. To develop perspective in relation to our true defense needs, it should be noted here that at the same time today, the armed forces have 134,000 men assigned to our total strategic capability. Ironically, we have become a nation forced to make policy and laws without the necessary information or knowledge. How can we do otherwise when the information required for an intelligent judgment is so often held secret by an executive who considers the Congress and the people its adversaries? The accusation that I did wrong by bringing forth information belonging to the executive only underscores the uniqueness of enforcing the obvious, the people's right to know what is going on in their government. This right must be continually reasserted if we are to remain a government of, by, and for the people. A Senate colleague on the other side of the aisle suggested that my security clearance should be taken away for what I had done. It is interesting to note that my security clearance was not given to me by any agency of the government, but it was given to me by the people of Alaska. I'm prepared to abide in 1974 by my fellow Alaskans' good judgment in this matter. Thank you.
Senator Gravel, an important part of the meetings of the Commonwealth Club of California is the active participation by the membership. And we have a great number of questions sent up for you to answer this afternoon from the members present. The first one, do you believe that all governmental policies and strategic matters involving the United States and other countries should be revealed to the American public?
No, not everything, and I think I stated in my prepared text, and that is that you have a question of executive privilege as personal privilege. And when I have discussions in that regard, I don't obviously broadcast them. There's no question that the military activities, as a basic part of its nature, require an element of secrecy. But I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about troop levels that should be secret. I'm not talking about the technology, some new advancement in weaponry. Deployment, what our battle plans would be if we had to utilize a certain course of action. I'm talking about total policy, the big broad picture, which in a representative society should be part of everybody's experience.
How have your Alaskan constituents reacted to your strong pro-peace positions and to your reading of the Pentagon Papers?
Essentially the same way as mail from Alaska on the Pentagon issue is run about the same thing as it has in other parts of the country. The mail's been about the same. I have a few newspapers that opposed me, that were Republican in my state, opposed me in 1968, will oppose me in 1974. So they were quick before to castigate my interest. But nobody, and it's been more of a nature of personal attacks, but nobody's really questioned what I've done as an act. That is, I've informed the American people. And nobody has dared move into a dialogue on that issue because that issue is very clear. If anybody has any doubts as to the motivation, then read the Pentagon Papers and make your own judgment. That's what a free society is all about.
Why the tears when you read the Pentagon Papers?
The weeping, as any male chauvinist like myself will readily admit to, is something that you don't want to do in public. What happened in my case was that I acquired the papers on Thursday and read them on Tuesday evening. The amount of pressure over those days was quite noteworthy. Similarly, most of my colleagues and friends that I brought privy to this information advised me of doing this, that it would end my political career. And I recall on Sunday evening talking with my wife and making a decision together that if this did mean the end of my political career, so be it. I felt it was important to try and find a way to stop the war, stop the killing. And it's a very frustrating thing because right now it's going on. And we're all party to it. Now, why can't we stop it? I felt that by giving information to the American people, this would have an effect. So that after I read the papers for about 3 hours and put the rest of the papers in the record so that then I could release it to the public. And so I started reading the statement, the introductory statement that I wanted to read on the floor of the Senate and was denied by Robert Griffin, the Republican whip. And in the statement came to a part, and of course, whenever people would advise me not to do this, I would always come to the conclusion and say, my God, we're killing people and we've got to do something about it. So that when I came in to my part of the speech that talked of, and I quoted some of it in the speech I gave you today, severing hands, metal crashing through bodies, I just became overcome over the insanity of it all and lost emotional control and started to weep. And then what I continued to talk of was the prideful area, which I think most Americans identify with. And that is, we've got a great country. We've got the greatest country in the history of man. And we've got a great military who do a great job. But the total tragedy of having this great nation, this peace-loving people, pushed around by these two-bit generals, these two-bit warlords and dope pushers, it was just more than we can tolerate. And that's the reason why I wept. And I think it's a valid reason to weep, and I think more should weep over the war.
Now, Senator, we have a couple of questions regarding Daniel Ellsberg. You remember him? Regarding Daniel Ellsberg, was he, in your opinion, guilty of violating government secrets and or is guilty of taking or stealing government property? The second question, should Ellsberg go unchastised? And if so, what effect will this have on future government secrets?
Well, I am not an attorney, so I am not prepared to talk about the intricacies of it. But I know the reason why he's not being prosecuted under the Espionage Act, and that is because under the Espionage Act, you have to want to willfully hurt your country. And obviously, Daniel Ellsberg loves his country and felt he was doing the right thing for his country. Now, with respect to the court case against him, all I can say is that I think he's a patriot. And if he's incarcerated and goes to jail for what he's done, then so be it. It's one of the unusual occurrences of our history. With respect to the issue of secrecy, I've tried to delineate the broad parameters of what I thought was very important, and that is that we have much, much too much secrecy in government today. That just the amount of secrecy that takes place in the peaceful uses of the atom, which is totally unrelated to the need for secrecy, and the only people that it's being hid from is yourselves. Now, maybe you don't want to find out what's going on in government. Maybe that's a good thing. Well, then you go ahead and live that way. But my view to government is that the more people we get involved, the better government we're going to have. And this country is in a bit of a mess, and the only way out is not by shrinking the volume of knowledge, but by opening up the floodgates and letting the light in, letting the people in, letting them participate. That is the only way we're going to survive as a society. So the issue of secrecy is going to be wrought with many difficulties. It's going to be wrought for difficulties for people in the military, people in the high echelon of the executive. But that's no reason to turn away from that problem. It's every reason to march towards it and realize that we've got to lower the barriers.
Were not most Americans totally opposed to the Vietnam War prior to your reading of the Pentagon Papers?
Yes, if you take the polls at their face value, and I think we must to a good degree, But then you see the uniqueness of our system, which is not a parliamentary system. It's a constitutional system, and that is where the people think they're voting for somebody who's going to bring peace, and then after he's elected, we continue to wage war. The statistic I gave you, which was very clear, and that is in 1968, the American people thought they were voting for peace. Now, they may not have been broadly acquainted of the intricacies of how to effect this, but I know one thing that the statistic proves, and that is that we're not effecting a close to this war when we take one-third of all the casualties that have been taking over five administrations. Those five administrations have had their hand in this thing. And this present administration, it says it's ending it, has taken one-third of the casualties, dead and wounded. My knowledge of ending the war and winding down the war is you end it. I've been asked many times by people who say, well, how would you do it? My statement sounds very glib, yet it's the most profound answer that I know and that I can give, and that is very simple. There's only one way to get out of Vietnam. That's on airplanes, and it's on boats. Now, other people will say, well, now we can't quite do that. We got this problem and that problem. There's no question, until you make a decision to do something, you can find any reason to delay the decision. The problem, in this case, is making the decision to get out and then getting out and not going through the rhetoric of prisoners of war, which is a straw man and a tragedy to the people who are held there, and not going through the rhetoric of the domino theory, which was bankrupted 6 years ago, and then not going through the rhetoric of giving them a chance when South Vietnam has a 1,100,000 troops under arms and North Vietnam has 250,000 under arms. And then when you talk about giving them a chance politically, when the election that's now taken place as a result of the phony law put through over the Memorial Day weekend, where the vice president, mind you, of a country can't qualify to run for president.
Are there reasons for political secrets? Was not the Kissinger-Chu meeting an example?
Quite the contrary. I'm very happy and applaud the president's move to China. The only criticism I have is how it was done. Why couldn't Henry Kissinger board a plane and go there in the light of day? Why did he have to do it in secret? Ask yourself that question. I'm a United States senator. I can't answer it, other than the fact that it has more flair. It looks better on the tube when you just sock it to the people and obliterate their sensibilities. Why couldn't he get into an airplane, fly to Tokyo, get off in Tokyo, stay overnight, rest a little bit, and then fly on to buy chartered aircraft to Peking and sit down and talk like a decent person, have the press in? Why all the secrecy? What's the big deal? We left our poor Japanese friends who've been carrying our water with our anti-People's Republic of China sitting at the church. They're still being anti-Chinese when we've just leapfrogged them and now we're dealing directly with them. How ridiculous. We should at least have the decency to tell our friends what we're doing and let them jockey for political position. I had a meeting shortly after with the ambassador from Japan, and I ingraciously asked, well, what has this done to your prime minister? And he says, oh, and he mumbled, not very good. And I says, well, how serious is it? And he mumbled, very serious. Well, we didn't have to go through all the charade. I do applaud the trip. But why was secrecy necessary? I ask that question to you.
Looking back on your reading of the Senate to the Senate of the Pentagon Papers, would you do it again?
Again and again and again and again and again.
Now, Senator, we still have a great number of questions regarding the Pentagon Papers, but we also have a large number of questions regarding the Alaska Pipeline. And as our time is getting a little short, I'd like to ask one or two and let you expound on the very controversial question in Alaska at the moment. What is the main purpose for constructing the Alaskan Pipeline? Do you think that goal will be achieved?
The main purpose is to get the oil we have discovered in Alaska to market, the oil. That oil represents about almost 50% of our U.S. reserves. By the year 1980, the United States will be importing in excess of 50%, or about 50% of its oil. So whether the oil comes from Alaska or comes from Venezuela, comes from Saudi Arabia, there'll be an element of risk in the denigration of the environment. We stand a better chance of monitoring that risk to its minimum if we control the means of transportation. So a tanker plying the waters of the Gulf of Alaska can come under more direct regulations than the rust bucket of Aristotle or Knossos. The problems, the technical problems of transporting the oil from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez is a very serious one. And it's one that I feel can be met engineering-wise. I've met with the scientists in question. The oil companies have given all of their data. And because of the industrial environmental confrontation we now face in this nation, we operate under a quid pro quo, and that is that one must now prove the efficacy of his industrial endeavor prior to being given permission to effect his endeavor. So in Alaska, being the cutting edge of this national and international crisis, the quid pro quo is very simple. Can the oil companies build this line safely? That decision will be made by the Secretary of the Interior within the next 60 days. Then the court that granted an injunction will rule upon the adequacy of this information as part of the 102, the Environmental Protection Statement. Now, if the data is sufficient and the court rules favorably, then the permit will be granted and construction will begin. I feel that this will be beneficial, one, to Alaska, because we're a very poor state and we need the benefits of this great economic find. And two, it'll be a benefit to the American people because they'll be consuming this fuel, which is so vital to our energy. This doesn't mean that I'm minimizing the effect upon our economy. But let me just say that in the new logic that is now becoming pervasive in our society, that we can demand of industry that it not denigrate the environment, that it be so minimal that the impact will be tolerable. All we've got to do is require this discipline. Think for a moment the idiocy of having two tankers collide under your famous bridge here. We have airplanes, thousands of airplanes in the skies of this country that go travel all over, and the collisions are minimal because they have the necessary navigational aids and the necessary regulations. We could implement similarly for ocean traffic. All we've got to do is want to do it, and I think we can, and I think the predisposition of the public is to bring this about.
Regarding the pipeline, in case of oil spills, who will bear the cost of repairing the damage, the oil company or the state of Alaska?
Probably everybody, because usually when there's something like that that happens, everybody bears a burden to one degree or other. Under the immediacy of it, of course, would be the oil companies. But on the long term, it would not be the oil companies, it would be you, the American consumer. Because if industry is faulty and inefficient, the people who pay for that inefficiency are the consumers, the American public.
Senator Mike Gravel, we have time but for one more question, and when you have answered this question, the meeting will stand adjourned. Before asking it, however, I wish to thank you on behalf of the more than 14,000 members of the Commonwealth Club of California for your very stimulating remarks this afternoon. The question is as follows. What is your reaction to President Nixon's economic measures?
Yeah, hang on for that one. That's a very good one. Before launching into that one, if I could just make one point of clarification, which I think would be very valuable. That is, the publication of the Pentagon Papers by Beacon Press will be four volumes, 1,000 pages each, 4,000 pages. It will be most of the documents and all of the narrative except for the diplomatic negotiations and all of the summaries. The book that's presently out, the Bantam book, is a book of 750 pages long and is really a reprinting of what was printed in the New York Times. Very fine, very well distilled, but the completeness of the Beacon edition will be, in essence, the straight material. With respect to the President's economic measures, and if I could take a moment to elaborate upon this, because I think it's most significant. It's been called the domestic trip to Peking, and it is every bit of that. First, the wage and price control, I agree and I applaud. In fact, I was stunned, as so many Democrats were stunned, because we've been criticizing the administration, telling them to get with the program and do something like this for nigh on 2 years. In fact, the legislation he implemented was legislation that we passed last year when we were saying that the economy was in trouble. Of course, the rhetoric in which this decision was couched was that, well, everything is fine, but we're just doing this. Obviously, the truth of the matter is that our nation has serious economic problems and that now we're beginning to see some leadership in this direction. Democrat or Republican, I'm happy to applaud him for this action. I can only say that it should have been extended to include wage, price, profits, and interest if it were really to operate across the board. I think it would have been much more equitable. Now, with respect to the priorities that are taking place, I think in a very partisan sense that I could say that we are seeing in this unique action and good action a sort of the rejuvenation of the trickle-down approach, because the people that are asked to sacrifice the most are the poor people, the deferment of welfare reform. And second, the people who work for government. They're not going to get their raise. Well, everybody knows that government employees aren't all that well paid, so it seems somewhat unfair to really make them carry most of the water. But that's what's been decided. Now, let's look where the benefits are. The benefits are a 10% investment tax credit to business. Well, this is very good. But the only thing I would qualify this somewhat, because the problem we have in our society today is not across the board for business, because we know we're not operating at full capacity. Yet this investment tax credit will go out and add additional plant to plant that's not always being used. What we need is an investment tax credit to guarantee that we have plant in need of becoming efficient is made efficient. It should be more selective. Secondly, the areas of environmental change and part of our industry, which is very expensive and costly, this is an area that we should have applied the investment tax credit. At the same time, it could have given us a great impetus into addressing ourselves to the ecological problems vis-a-vis industry. Now, with respect to the 10% surcharge on imports, I think that that is a unique device. I probably would not have employed it because I think what the administration's after is to force Japan into evaluating the yen upwards. The Germans will accept this. The only two people who really could hurt us in a retaliatory action would be the West Germans and the Japanese. But because it's a 90-day short-term action, you won't see any retaliation because they'll anticipate that this will be lifted. But where it does hurt, it hurts the small countries we do business with where some type of export is very vital to their economy. The other, floating the dollar in Europe, what we've done is we've devalued the dollar without hurting our ego. And I think this is very good and very salutary and very stimulating. We've been in trouble, and the best thing you can do is when you have a problem is you recognize it and correct it. And that's exactly what the president has done in the international community, and I'm not at all disturbed by the moaning and groaning of many nations abroad. We were overvalued our dollar. It hurt the people of this country. It hurt business. It hurt the working man. And it's about time we just owned up to it and corrected it. And I think the president did it in a very skillful manner, minimizing what impact it would have on the great American id, which is, of course, so big because we are such a great country and we're entitled to have a great id. Thank you. Good day. Let's have your back again.